welcome to the podcast show today. It's myself, Jamie, here, and we have Juliana here as well.
Hi, Jamie. Nice to be here.
Hello. This show is the brainchild of the BTS Nest group, the BTS being the British Toxicological Society, and the Nest being the Network for Early Stage Toxicologists. And the aim of the group itself is to improve the interconnection and engagement between senior and early stage toxicologists. So what we're trying to do here is showcase and highlight the work of these exceptional toxicologists and these people who are established in their fields. So in this episode of the podcast, we're talking to Professor Anne Willis today at the MRC in Cambridge. We're excited to be here in person.
Thank you for inviting us here today.
No, it's lovely to see you. It's nice to have people in person. It makes such a change for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know certainly it's good to actually be somewhere where it feels like there's actual things going on.
Yeah, real science is taking place.
Oh, yeah, we've been up and running since, I guess, May. Very, very, you know, and we've been recruiting a lot. So it's busy. Yeah, it's busy here. Everyone's in the lab. We've had no in-work transmission of virus at all, despite people having cases and coming in. Across the university, we've been really, really successful in that. But when you've got the right things in place, it doesn't transmit. Good ventilation, masks, distancing, not hard, actually.
And we can see that it does work in the working environment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just all about taking those precautions and making sure that you factor in exposure. Things, all stuff that we should be familiar with, right?
Yes.
Before we get into our episode, let me just tell you a little bit about Professor Anne Willis, OBE. Anne is the director of the MRC Toxicology Unit. She has an international reputation as a leader in the field of post-transcriptional control of gene expression. And there are just too many firsts to mention, really. Her laboratory was one of the first to identify internal ribosome entry segments in cellular mRNAs. I hope I've got that right.
Perfect, yes.
And her group were the first to demonstrate how post-transcriptional control pathways are used to control gene expression following toxic insult. A little more about this later. Anne has worked with the Imperial Cancer Research Fund laboratories, now known as the Cancer Research UK, and has held both a research fellowship and various university lectureships. In 2010, she was appointed director of the MRC Toxicology Unit. In 2015, she was appointed a member of the EMBO and an OBE. And my favourite, in 2018, she was appointed a fellow of the BTS.
Yes, that was very exciting, actually. It was just lovely to have the work we've done recognised of the unit as a whole.
And actually, you are author and co-author of so many publications, and I love some of the titles of these publications. Who thinks up these titles? We have Don't Shoot the Messenger, Shoot the Reader, Should I Stay or Should I Go?, and Uncharged tRNA to the Rescue.
Well, those are mostly when we've been asked to, quite often we asked to review papers in quite major journals, and then things that we recommend for publication, they're quite often asked to write a detailed commentary on kind of why we like it and where it should go. And I often ask people in my lab to get involved in that. I think it's really good for them to read papers, put it into context of the field as a whole, and they're allowed to come up with cheesy, funny titles. So one of them was Frozen, Let It Go, which made me laugh. But yes, I think the titles and the songs reflect the age of the people who are writing the review.
Oh, you're never too young to enjoy the Clash, though.
No, well, yes, maybe. It's my era, you see, of being an ancient dinosaur.
That is great. So, Anne, I'm so excited to have you on our BTS podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to put you on edge too much, but this is our first feature podcast today. So, we're excited on that front as well.
There are just so many things I want to ask you about. I have about 1,000 questions. Where do I begin? Well, let's go back. Let's go all the way back. Let's hear more about your story. Tell me, what was your favourite subject in school?
Biology.
Lovely.
And I had my first microscope was my 7th birthday present.
Wow, young.
I always was very interested in science. It's like what I liked doing most. And yeah, so it went on from there. I'm doing the job that I wanted to do as a child. So that's, yeah, not the doctor, not the dentist. I wanted to be a scientist.
There you go. What sort of things were you putting in the microscope when you were 7?
You know, it's terribly low power, right? So things like, spots of blood, and you can have a look at red blood cells, and bits of insect wing. If you find a dead fly or something, have a look at a wing. All that, you know, because the power is low, but just fascinating actually seeing the world blown up and just wondering how they come to be and how they're so different, etc. So those sorts of things from an early child.
You were just born a biologist.
I was born a biologist, yes.
Yeah, I definitely had a microscope as well when I was quite little, and I could relate to that. I definitely used to find anything in the garden that I could possibly stick onto a slide and have a look at and get right down in. It was going on there. So yeah, I definitely can relate to that.
Great. Okay, so we've had your school days. Then you went off to university. You did several degrees. Can you talk to me a little about that?
So I did, my first degree was in University of Kent. I did a degree in biochemistry, which I really, really enjoyed. And we were incredibly lucky, looking back, that they actually were very enlightened and they realised we need to get as much research experience as possible. They actually paid us money. It seems incredible now. The university paid us as a year group to each go and find a summer job in our second year. So we had paid employment that was funded by the university. And so, of course, you can turn up to someone's lab. You're not going to cost them anything. And I got a job working in the summer at the Imperial Science Research Fund in the middle of London with Beverly Griffin. And then that really fueled me on to want to do more research. It was an amazing experience. And then I went back there the following summer. They invited me back, but they paid me that time. And then I did my PhD, in fact, with Beverly's husband, Thomas Lindahl. So that's where it had come from. So it was the kind of support that we had from the university. I mean, if anybody ever has an opportunity to get to do some summer work, really recommend they take it. It can make such a difference to you going forward.
What an opportunity. That's amazing to think they really paid you back then.
They paid us, yeah. I mean, it was a very long time ago. We had £25 a week, which seemed like a lot then. That was enough. It was enough to kind of, you know, pay your travel in and out and lunches, etc. That's all kind of you needed at that point. You know, most people were living at home in the summer anyway. I had the one downside was I was working in central London, in Lincoln's Inn Fields, and it was incredibly hot on the train.
I can imagine.
And I used to dread getting on the tube at night to go home after work because it was very hot and people were quite smelly. that was the one down bit.
Maybe that kept you in the labs a little longer.
Yeah, a bit later to cool down slightly.
And then you went on to have a postdoctorship?
Yep, so I did my PhD, and then I wanted to do was the advent of molecular biology. And I knew that I needed really to get more molecular experience. This is a time so long ago that, you know, restriction, and we had EcoR1 and one other. It seems extraordinary now if you think about the cloning and what's available. And, you know, you weren't allowed to actually suck any of the enzyme up into your Gilson pipette. You could touch it on the end because it was so precious because it was so expensive. But I wanted to do more molecular biology. So I came to Cambridge to work with Richard Perham, who was doing really groundbreaking work in that area. And I was here for, I guess, I had 3 years. I had a postdoc in his lab. And then I'd had a junior research fellowship at Churchill College at the same time. And I'd done quite a lot of undergraduate supervision, which I loved. Such fun students I used to teach. And then the college paid me as 1 year as a lecturer. So I was sort of had this college position, but I carried working in Richard's lab at the time. It was exhausting because I did hours and hours of teaching every week. But it was great because it gave me a salary to explore things that I wanted to do at the time, which was really good.
Sounded very busy. How did you have the energy for all of that?
I was shattered because I was sort of trying to teach 12 hours a week, which was a lot, and run, you know, and working in the lab as well. So that was very tiring.
And which aspect did you enjoy the most then? You teaching and your research?
Oh, I mean, both. Yeah, both. It was just I had very funny, very nice students who I used to teach. The funniest thing was I'd always just said to them, as we discussed earlier, just call me Anne. And they couldn't quite cope, particularly then. Things were more formal. and I think it freaked them out a bit. So then I used to have letters from saying hi, because they wouldn't know what to put as a title, which always just used to crease me up somewhat. So you used to just, in the end, they couldn't cope. They used to avoid calling me anything at all and thought that I hadn't noticed.
Oh dear. It's nice to see that there isn't a big divide between the director of a MRC unit and we can talk to you on a one-to-one basis. That's fab.
Yeah, everyone's all people at the end, right? Yeah. So it doesn't make a big difference.
So throughout that time then, in the various universities and teaching, when did you find toxicology?
Oh, so I guess in a way, because I've always been very interested in DNA damage, DNA repair, exposure, which is all kind of one aspect of sort of genotox area. It's something I've always worked on. That was what my PhD was on. I did more molecular biology, and it was a bit different when I had postdocs in Cambridge. But then I went back to those aspects of it again when I took up SOT in my own lab. And the whole big tox thing only really came through when I took over the unit and looked at actually what we should do direction-wise and how we should shape new medicines and the place that we should go. What, you know, what I think is important for us to be doing. It's very forward-looking. MRC have this slightly horrendous word they use, is horizon scanning. So we do a lot of that. But it's important because it's such an exciting area and it has to be current, it has to be up front. We have to work in parallel with new medicines as well. So it's taking over the unit that really galvanised that more, though we were always doing work that was on the edge of tox anyway, all the way through.
Yeah. A lot of the committees, they're always horizon scanning. And I never know, is it being pushed by the universities? Is it being pushed by commercial outfits? Or is government and regulation trying to keep up with them all? I'm never quite sure who's leading and which horizons we're following.
I think with tox, you've always got to be ahead of the game. And you've got to be looking at actually what might be the next thing to come through. So you've got the assays and the molecular understanding so that can be really help the drug development if you knew what the big issues were before they get there, and you have better predictive tox. The whole AI thing's fascinating. That's the way it's going in the future. And that's what's going to be really, really important.
Okay, so you're an OBE, sorry to bring it up, but it is amazing. I've never met someone with an OBE before. Incredibly exciting. Were you expecting it?
No, it was an utter, utter shock. So I had a brown envelope came in the post and I thought it was a tax bill. You know, those sort of ones with the mid-window.
Yes.
Ugh, what have I not paid now? And then it was on the grottiest quality paper. It just really not even photocopy paper, sort of horrible paper. And I said to my husband, is this real? Do you think this is a joke? So I hadn't told because I was never 100%. So I feel there's a form, they send you a form saying, if you were offered it, would you accept it? So there's not an embarrassment to the Queen or whatever by saying I don't want it when they've offered it. So I filled the form and sent it off, but I just wasn't convinced it was real. So I didn't tell anybody. Only my husband and my son knew. And I didn't tell my sister, who is also a scientist. And she was very cross because her friend had said to her, your sister's got an OBE. And she had to pretend that she knew. And I had this cross text from her, why did you not tell me? So I was just so, you know, and also on New Year's Eve, when the list is open, my husband was looking for me and we couldn't find my name. So I thought, oh, thank God for that. I've not told anybody. It's fine. And then we did find it and then we were celebrating. But you just think, you know, it was just such an honour and so unexpected. It really was.
Fabulous. And on New Year's Eve, you sort of saw your name printed.
Yeah, that's what you can do. And then you can text your friends, check the list.
How exciting. How did you achieve this award? Was it for a particular research project you did, particular outcome?
I was on MRC strategy board and I had quite a lot of input, I think, into shaping and pushing the TOPS agenda there. And so the award is actually for biological sciences, but also supporting the careers of women. So I would be there as a reminder that women have a very big place to play in science and there's not enough of us. And I think a trouble with big organisations, they end up, the whole thing unconscious bias, but people tend to recruit in their own image. And if you have a lot of white alpha males. It's not always good when you come to recruit women who are not in that set. I mean, there are a lot of alpha women out there as well, but you don't have to be one defined personality type to achieve in science. It needs everybody. So I think I would point that out quite a lot. And I've had wonderful women who I've worked with and who I've helped mentor, and just so proud of the achievements that people have had just from saying, yes, you can do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's all you need, really.
Yeah, everyone sort of needs to be told at whatever age, yes, we can do it, yeah.
Certainly, I think in the BTS Nest Committee, I think it's predominantly women.
There are more, I mean, what depresses me, but I think we need to think more creatively, and I'm trying to think more creatively how we do things, is there's lots of young women around, but in terms of a science career, it's very punishing when people get to their 30s and have families. And it's not that it can't be done, and it's not, and people want to spend time with their children, and that's okay. But it's hard to do that and science at the level of commitment that you require in your early 30s at the same time.
Yes.
And I think that there needs to be greater thought about job sharing, in actual fact, and part-time working. As a PI, I'm talking about part-time PI working. In one way to do it, maybe, would be to have, you know, so my thoughts have come because I've had a Wellcome Trust Investigator Award, but a joint one with a female friend of mine, colleague friend, Catherine Lee. We joint run this project. We've been so successful. It's wonderful working together. We're both senior corresponding authors on the papers. We just flip names around. So we massively achieve on this joint project. We could have done it on our own, which we chose to do it joint. And actually, there's no reason not to take that model in to have PIs both running a lab together, providing some, you have to have a good, very, very good relationship and trust. But, you know, I'm away half the week. My lab still runs when I'm not here. It's not as though you have to be there at your desk every minute of every day. So I think more part-time working to allow women to stay in as a PI till children are a bit bigger and they have a bit more time, and so allow them to do both. I think there needs to be more thought, because I always thought when I was younger there weren't many women at all and it would get better, and now there are far more women, but just not at a senior level, and it's the 30s, it's the absolute crash point. There's massive drop-off, and I completely get why it happens. And then, you know, it's a hard career, fun but hard, and I think you just need to make sure people stay in the workplace for those difficult, you know, 3 to 5 years. It's not forever. And then to, you know, go on again with their careers when children are a little bit bigger. And, you know, and it's lovely to spend time with your family when they're small. You know, you don't want to deny people that opportunity either. So I think that needs to be considered, more joint PI positions.
Mm. Yeah, it's good to see that you can still job share, even though you don't need to, and prove to everyone that it's possible, especially with the pandemic and everyone is away from offices and labs.
Yeah.
That we've realised, okay, it can work.
Yeah, you don't have to, you know, be there all the time. It's more flexibility than people realise, I think.
So we've talked a little bit about the past. What's the current work being done at the MRC Toxicology Unit here in Cambridge? What projects are there currently going on?
So we've got a number of things. We try to address sort of future needs of newer medicines, and then some slightly more historical things at the same time that still remain an issue. Well, it's a mixture between a little bit of consumer products, but not so much. A lot of pharma-related work, and then some environmental work. So we span all three things. But we have 10 programmes and about 120 researchers here, so we can't do everything. We do a lot, but we can't do everything. So in terms of the new medicines, I thought quite a while ago, so we were ahead of the curve, which I was saying before, that RNA therapies are really going to be really important new medicines of the future. So this is a whole post-transcriptional control thing that my lab does and Ritwik Sarokar does. So working on RNA therapeutics, so the toxicity associated with antisense oligos, because they are the things that offer hope of actually cure from genetically inherited disease. So at the moment, they're mostly being used to target things like Huntington's, for example. But as we move forward, there'll be less you know, maybe longer term chronic conditions can be treated that way as well. And if we're going to use them as those sorts of treatments, then we've really got to understand long term tox associated with those.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're also working on in vitro modified RNAs and possible toxicities associated with those, and looking at efficacy that surrounds those.
So important.
Yeah. And then the other thing we're doing in terms of tox, so we've got a degree working on immune modulation. So they're working on some of the cancer drugs. So they have, you know, the immune checkpoint inhibitors that are very, very successful, but they know there's serious on-target tox associated with those. So you can get damage, you know, thyroiditis, you can get loss of thyroid glands for some people. Some things are manageable, other things are myocarditis, for example, is not always manageable. So you've got to be able to predict who's going to get what sort of tox with those, and that's not known at present. And then we also have a group working on cell-based therapies, so CAR T cells in particular. And that's extraordinary because you get either cures or you can get cytokine release syndrome. You know, it seems to be a bit one or the other with that at the moment. So trying to actually understand, I guess, idiosyncratic tox, why some people get one and not the other, but within a pretty small group. We've got people working on mitochondria still, because that's always going to be an onward issue, because, you know, people might, well, I'm sure the tox community are aware, that's one of the big things that get hit in tox is mitochondria. And then a lot of the cardiac tox is because things have an off-target effect on mitochondria, the mitochondrial toxin effects there. And then in terms of the environmental work, well, we've got a new PI who's joined us in that space, and he's looking at sort of tyre and brake wear. So we've moved away from things like diesel, because hopefully going forward that's not going to be part of the UK's fuel going forward. But with electric cars, tyre and brake wear is still an issue, and we collaborate with the MRC Centre for the Environment and Health on those projects. But also we're doing some work with someone in engineering who's here, and he's got very large trucks that he runs up and down the runway at Bourne Airport, and they collect real-world samples. To make you laugh, the PhD student who's just joined on that project was hoping to get to drive the trucks. I think they may be able to run some of the engines in the lab, so he's a bit disappointed. So I think he thought that was going to be extraordinary. And then also we've got one person in particular who's working on some DARTs, so developmental and reproductive toxicity. He's got some really interesting models he does where you can actually look at your neutro exposure in animal models and actually try to understand some of the work in that space as well, in terms of epigenetic inheritance. Oh, yeah. Though things are reset on fertilisation in theory, that does need more looking at, and not, you know, you might reset the genome, but you don't reset microRNAs, for example, at that point. So, yeah, we've got this. It's a range of things tackling kind of older but newer medicines and current environmental issues as well.
I'm interested actually now in the tyre and brake wear. It struck me as something that we probably don't often consider when we think of any sort of environmental exposure from vehicles. We always tend to think of exhaust fumes and things like that, of course. But like you say, all of these things are, you know, that you do get that wear and tear, and they are perishable. And I guess then there must be a difference then in your exposure to these things, even depending on how close to, say, a train platform you stand to the train and how close to the road you are on the pavement.
So Frank Kelly, you know, and Paul Elliott, who direct the unit in Imperial, who do a lot of real-world collecting of data of these sorts of samples, you know, they have people on the tube. I mean, it's heavy metal exposure as well from the tube is an issue as well. But, yeah, it does make a difference where you stand. I tend to do things like, if I'm in London, I walk down quieter streets, and you don't want to walk near the pavement edge. Your exposure decreases quite a lot as you walk nearer the buildings. So you can actually reduce your overall exposure to these things by where you walk and not choose to go down the really busy routes. It does make a very big difference in terms of exposure and city exposure. Mm. And this will continue to be an issue going forward. So they've got some input from Goodyear Tyres, are keen. I mean, this is kind of helping inform what the problems are. So you can have the whole notion, the whole, or Saved by Design. I mean, we've done quite a lot of work on carbon nanotubes unit. This is Marit Farland led that study, and that's been fascinating, actually, about the toxicity associated with some of the things that were brought in to replace asbestos are as toxic, because the hazard mechanism is kind of the same.
What with the being long, thin tubes and stuff like that, you're looking for things like mesotheliomas.
Yeah, it had a very nice paper that was published in, it was 2017 now, it's been very highly cited, showing that carbon nanotubes are the same aspect ratio as asbestos fibres cause the same disease and the same molecular signature. We've got some work going on to understand, basically make them shorter, but if you can actually change some of the chemistries as well that surround that, sort of nitrogen doping and things as well, can change some of that. So I'm not saying that that's what they're going to do with the tyres, but it's like a parallel thing, really understanding where the likely toxicity is coming from and then having input into the manufacturing process for the manufacturer to use that process to actually make safer tyres that have less harmful effects on human health.
It's amazing how we haven't learned from the mistakes of the past. So much research has gone into asbestos and the effects of asbestos, and you know, we've known about it for years, and then we go and create the modern asbestos, carbon nanotubes.
Yeah, I think they were thinking more probably that maybe it was some of the mineral. Well, they've known for years about the aspect ratio being key, actually. Then you make something that has the same, or you stop. I mean, companies have stopped making them anymore. They would make these long, thin fibres, etc. And it's. I guess the risk is at points of exposure. So probably things are made under very, very careful conditions in factories, but then what happens when they're broken down, when they're disposed of? Where do they go then? What are they likely to do? So, I mean, the thing would be not to have things of that length. It's a form, you know, Safe by Design is the whole byword of that industry.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency when we look at exposure to things in the environment as a whole to assume that things exist in the way that they've been manufactured and are consistently so, particularly from what I've seen. So, yeah, it's worth consideration.